Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This podcast is free, and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
Who needs teenage punk rock nightclubs anyway? In fact, who needs punk rockers? If ever the rest of us needed to put our foot down and say enough is enough, the time is now.
It's November 27th, 1985. The all-ages disco known as the Monastery has been gone for 5 months after being shut down by court order. Seattle's mayor, city council, and parents' rights advocates say all-ages clubs like the Monastery have fueled a teen runaway crisis and rampant underage drug use. So they've waged a successful campaign to crack down on teen nightlife. Back in July, they passed the Teen Dance Ordinance, a law that makes hosting all-ages dances impossibly complicated and expensive. Now they're using the TDO to take down a new target.
I can't buy the argument that we must provide nightclubs for teenagers because they don't have anything to do. If they can't find anything to do, I think it's because the world of drugs and booze made attractive by punk rock has them mesmerized, and because they haven't the good sense to try something worthwhile.
Lou Guzzo was a TV commentator for Cairo 7 News in Seattle in the early 80s. Guzzo was a professional curmudgeon in the vein of Andy Rooney. He'd appear on air a few times a week to unload whatever was on his mind. Today, Lou was particularly worked up. What caught his attention were the unprecedented events that occurred in his beloved city the night before.
An adult and five juveniles are in custody tonight following a melee last night outside a Seattle punk rock nightclub.
The club was called Gorilla Gardens. The band performing that night was an up-and-coming act called Circle Jerks. Seattle police shut down the show, and the ensuing chaos would be known as the Gorilla Gardens Riot. It was the first ever enforcement of the TDO.
Instead of the ugly hairdos and ridiculous makeup and costumes of punk rock, the teenagers so inclined might try the real world for a change. I think they'd find better entertainment in skiing, swimming, hiking, climbing, biking, camping, movies, video games, and something as revolutionary as reading and learning.
To Lou's credit, he does approve of video games as constructive entertainment. Pretty progressive in 1985. But it turns out he had good reason to be mad. Angry punks fought back against the cops.
Several police cars and a fire department car were damaged after the youth began throwing things at police. But as always, there are two sides to a story, and some of the teenagers who were there last night say the police roughed them up.
The accusations of police brutality apparently escaped Lou Guzzo. Maybe he was unaware that cops had been beating the crap out of Seattle punks for years.
We have no obligation to provide teenagers nightclubs and opportunities for mayhem. In fact, I think our obligation is just the opposite, to prevent them from ruining their lives.
The Gorilla Gardens riot was the opening skirmish in a war between Seattle's music community and establishment forces, a war that waged for 17 years, and in the process, dramatically altered the world-changing music that would soon explode out of this city. The battle lines were drawn. Punks were ready for a fight.
Let the kids dance. Let the kids dance.
I don't think the punk rockers will go away if we ban teenage nightclubs, but I think it would be a good start.
Buckle up, Lou. The kids hate the teen dance ordinance. The fight for Seattle's soul is just beginning. For KUOW in Seattle, I'm Jonathan Zwickel, and this is Let the Kids Dance.
Hey there, I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of a podcast called Bay Curious that answers listener questions about the Bay Area.
How did all of this eucalyptus get to the Bay Area?
Does it take for water to get from Hetch Hetchy to San Francisco?
Want to know the answers? Subscribe to the Bay Curious podcast or visit baycurious.org.
The truth is, Seattle has never been a welcoming place for youth culture, and especially not for punk rock. The first punk club in Seattle was called The Bird. It opened in 1978, a full 7 years before the TDO, inside a former office supply warehouse in Pioneer Square. A dedicated concert venue that wasn't a bar or theater of some kind was a radical concept. So was its door policy. The Bird was open to everyone, the very first all-ages rock club in Seattle. And it was an instant hit.
There was no other place for the kids to come to dance.
Suzanne Grant was the lead singer of The Enemy, one of Seattle's early punk bands. Back then, she was in her late teens.
Where could they even play? They couldn't play in these liquor bars. There's no alcohol there, and so they could come under 18.
Search online and you can find shaky black and white footage of The Bird's opening night. Proto-punk rockers and mods strut around the place, taking photos against a white backdrop and dancing to loud music.
It was the scene, right? Everyone dressed up and posed with their dyed hair and their safety pins and all that sort of thing. But this is the place where people dressed up and came out.
The footage depicts a wildly divergent fashion show. Skinny ties and sport jackets, ringer tees and cut-off shorts, fur coats and bell-bottoms. Fabulous and lowbrow, all at once. Art Chantry, perhaps the foremost grunge graphic designer, later said about The Bird, the entire audience on opening night eventually formed their own bands. The Mentors played the makeshift stage. They wore executioner's hoods over their heads. The drummer used a 2x4. Performance art as much as musical performance. The Bird was a cavernous space. The walls were painted in graffiti, then painted black to cover the graffiti. The crowd was teens and young 20-somethings, with kids as young as 12 mixing with the occasional old hippie in their 30s or 40s. Teenage Duff McKagan was a regular before he moved to L.A. and started Guns N' Roses. Mainly local bands played, but sometimes acts from L.A. and San Francisco came through. A couple hundred people might show up, overcrowding the place and attracting attention from authorities. Throngs of outrageously dressed young people sporting weird hairdos spilling out onto the street. The cops didn't like what they saw. They used the word punk like an epithet, called them other more degrading names. It was a short run for The Bird. 3 months after it opened, the fire marshal shut it down. The final night was on June 1st, 1978. The Enemy played to a packed house. Sometime after midnight, some partiers climbed onto the roof of the building and started throwing stuff onto the street below. Something hit a passing car, which happened to be occupied by Seattle police.
The car came screeching, and then these men in dark clothing come storming into this narrow hallway. And, hey, you gotta get me, like yelling at us.
Undercover officers started tossing people out of the club. A Seattle Times report says that when one concert goer asked for identification, a cop smashed his badge into the kid's face, drawing blood.
This is where I started singing one of my songs. I won't take any more manipulation or feel any more inner frustration. I demand disassociation from these waves of oppression. Great lyrics, right? My mind is mine. My mind is mine. I'm sure they loved that, right?
A cop grabbed Suzanne's arm and twisted it behind her back. In the process, he broke her wrist. Enemy guitarist Damon Titus complained about Grant's treatment, and officers responded by throwing him onto the sidewalk. A photographer on the scene happened to have a portable tape recorder and captured audio of the mayhem. A month later, The Enemy incorporated that audio into a song called Trendy Violence. Suzanne and 14 others were charged with reckless endangerment for what went down at The Bird. In retaliation, they claimed they were victims of police brutality. And they must have had a good case because they settled out of court. Terms were not disclosed. From the late 70s through the early 80s, Seattle's punk scene expanded alongside its shaggier cousin, heavy metal. The two styles stayed mostly separate. Metal flourished in the suburbs east of Lake Washington, while punk and new wave took root in the city. Bands and promoters put on all-ages concerts in roller rinks and art galleries, auto garages, and empty warehouses. One of the few actual venues that operated at the time was called Guerrilla Gardens. The place was a rock and roll paradise. All ages, barely monitored, low stakes. Slash, you know, the guitarist from Guns N' Roses, he described it as the epitome of a punk rock shithole. Maybe so, but Guerrilla Gardens holds a very special place in Seattle music history and has nothing to do with the riot that happened there.
This bar was here, but it was much more seedy. And the,
it was seedier than
way
it is now.
More seedy. Wow. Yeah,
this place is pretty.
I'm standing outside the former Guerrilla Gardens with David Portnow. In 1985, David was a 14-year-old doorman at the club, working after school almost every day. Today, he's our wiry, excitable tour guide through the International District. He's wearing a Pig Records t-shirt, merch from one of the several record labels he's run since he was a teenager. The place he's pointing out is boarded up, painted a dull gray. Today, it's utterly silent. But back in 1984 and 85, when it hosted live music almost every night of the week, it would have been packed with music fans inside and out.
Well, your metalheads had long hair, leather. Your metalhead women, they were absolutely gorgeous. They're wearing the tight spandex. They had long, gorgeous hair and were always extremely clean. The punk girls wore dreads. There were mohawks and stuff, but not these modern fake mohawks. These people had mohawks from the second they walked up until the second they went down.
The club was located in a building that once housed a two-screen Chinese movie theater. The guy who ran it, Tony Chu, turned its two separate theater spaces into two separate stages that ran at the same time. The Omni Room hosted punk and new wave, and the Rock Theater was dedicated to metal. Chu's pairing of disparate musical tribes under one roof was dicey. Brawls between punks and metalheads were common. But Chu made the genius decision to charge a single price to access both rooms. The rival clans couldn't deny the cheap cover. The result was alchemical.
Back then, if you're into punk, you didn't get along with metalheads. And if you're into metal, you hated punks. That all started changing about 85 to 90. And this was one of the first places in the world where that took place. They commingled, and by the commingling, some of the bands kind of played a crossover.
That crossover and commingling between punk and metal, the music it spawned became Seattle's signature sound. According to Seattle lore, Guerrilla Gardens gave the world grunge. Green River might be the first band to master the sound. The conditions necessary to spawn that kind of revolutionary music are rare. But in these moments of revelation, young people are always present. Rock and roll, punk, hip-hop, rave, all these groundbreaking modern musical styles were born from youth culture. At their very first practice in 1984, the guys in Green River were barely into their 20s. They played Guerrilla Gardens a bunch of times, then they went on to start Pearl Jam and Mudhoney. David estimates that 60% of the concertgoers at the club were teenagers.
These were good, all-age kids. Most of them didn't drink or smoke or do anything.
In its short time in the International District, Guerrilla Gardens hosted some of Soundgarden's earliest shows. Sonic Youth, Husker Du, Guns N' Roses, The Ramones, Afrika Bambaataa, Butthole Surfers, Dead Kennedys, Descendants, they all played their first Seattle shows there to all-ages crowds. At a Violent Femmes concert, cops threatened to shut it all down because the venue lacked a secondary egress. Someone fired up a chainsaw and cut a hole in the wall. Voila, second egress.
That's the best the Seattle music scene has ever been. The all-ages scene has never recovered. That's not because the scene wouldn't have continued. That's because Seattle went out of its way to ruin it with the teen dance ordinance. People see the movie Footloose and they're kind of laughing. Well, that really happened. I lived that. This happened in one of the most liberal cities in the United States.
The TDO was enacted in July of 1985. The new law brought too much heat to the well-known club. By September, less than a year after he started hosting shows at Guerrilla Gardens, Tony Chu shut it down. But then he came across an opportunity he couldn't refuse. Back then, Circle Jerks were not the punk rock royalty they are today. They were just four young dudes from Los Angeles hauling around in a van on a shoestring West Coast tour. But they were on the rise, and Tony jumped at the chance to put them on. He relocated Guerrilla Gardens across town to a former auto parts warehouse in Queen Anne and booked the band to perform there. He didn't bother with any of the provisions the TDO required, the police security, the million-dollar insurance policy. It was punk rock.
The idea of playing Seattle was great for us. Get out of town, go play some faraway exotic places.
Keith Morris has been the lead singer of Circle Jerks since the band formed in 1979. He says he remembers pulling into a desolate part of Seattle for their show on November 26, 1985. About 350 people showed up, a pretty good turnout considering it was a Tuesday night, and a snowstorm was raging through the Pacific Northwest.
The people that couldn't afford to get in, or the people that were just hanging out on the sidewalk, thought they would be clever, and every time the front door opened so somebody could go into the club or somebody was leaving the club, they'd throw a snowball through the front door. You know, maybe trying to hit the band on stage, or, you know, hit one of their friends in the crowd or what have you.
The venue was bare bones, just music blasting from a makeshift stage in an empty warehouse. David Portnow worked the door. $6 to get in. His brother was in the opening band, the Dehumanizers. The Circle Jerks had just gone on stage. The crowd was dancing madly when suddenly, without warning,
the police come in with a fireman, and they didn't say anything.
David and I are now outside a self-storage place on the backside of Queen Anne Hill. In 1985, it was the second iteration of Guerrilla Gardens. On that snowy November night, the cops had found the place, possibly tipped off by a noise complaint.
They just pushed me out of the way, and they go straight back, and they were in there, I would say, about 40 seconds, and then all the lights and everything go off.
Just like at the Bird 7 years earlier, David says the cops didn't announce themselves, didn't say anything as they burst in.
About 10:30 last night, 20 squad cars and dozens of Seattle police officers moved in on the Guerrilla Gardens Rock Club. They went inside accompanied by the fire marshal with instructions to shut down the place and effectively stop the music. They did. But outside,
almost 30 police officers, 20 squad cars, to pull the plug on a punk show. They plunged the room into sudden darkness and total confusion.
Nobody can see. Nobody knows what the hell is going on. And then a couple of more cops stopped, just came running in. They had their batons out and just started hitting people. Nobody had any warning whatsoever. And one of them threw me out the front door, and I got hit on the head and in the ribs with the baton. I was 15 years old. I wasn't doing anything wrong. You know, I was trying to figure out what's going on to help get the people out safely. And it wasn't that easy for them to get everybody out of there because there were no lights.
People were using cigarette lighters to find the door. And once they got there,
there was an officer here. There was two officers here. And they would run up and hit people as they came out the door. Some of them avoided hitting the women. One of them liked hitting the women.
David remembers cops focusing on a black concert goer coming out of the door.
The cop says, "Somebody get the," and they beat the living shit out of him. I mean, batons on the ground, kicking him. It was like Rodney King.
Punks were used to harassment from the cops, but this was a new level of violence. Hundreds of kids lined one side of the street, cops on the other. The kids started pelting them with snowballs. Despite the frozen streets, Seattle TV news station Cairo 7 sent a crew to the scene.
Several police cars and a fire department car were damaged after the youth began throwing things at police.
The things they threw included Molotov cocktails. The warehouse was in a residential neighborhood, and around the corner were recycling bins full of glass bottles.
Everybody had big cars back then, which have big gas tanks, so Molotov cocktails going everywhere. They start packing snowballs with rocks and stuff, and I'm proud to say we handed everything back to the police that they gave us and a lot more, and they deserve every bit of it.
The guitarist for the Dehumanizers was the son of a bricklayer, and he'd driven his dad's pickup to the show. The bed was full of masonry.
every single one of those bricks were thrown, and you know, it was two wrongs that happened that night, but they hit us in the head. Well, guess what? You're going to take a brick to the head.
I'm surprised that the police even showed up. Let the kids party. Let the kids do their thing. They're over there. We know that they're over there. Just let them do whatever they're going to do.
The snowstorm shut down bus routes for the night and made driving dangerous, leaving the kids pinned down by cops. They couldn't get home, and their parents weren't coming, so they fought back. They started bonfires with siphoned gas, broke police and fire department vehicle windows. David says they battled for hours. Six people ended up getting taken to jail that night. Tony Chu was charged with violating the TDO for not having a proper license to open the club. It was the last show he'd ever book under the Gorilla Gardens name. The next day, Cairo News claimed the youth attacked police. But along with footage of the riot, the reporter also interviewed three kids who were at the concert. They described the beatings they took at the hands of the cops.
In the back of the head with his nightstick and in the ribs, then in the leg.
With a nightstick?
Yeah.
Did he talk to you?
He said, get out of here.
No name, no number, yeah. No badge number. What went through your mind when that was happening?
I was scared because I saw two police. One yelled, I want him.
I think the police should not be on anybody's body with those sticks at all, let alone a kid.
The boy's mom was angry about what happened that night. Not that her son was at an illegal punk rock show, but that the cops roughed him up. The TDO was only 4 months old, but already Seattle police were enforcing it with malice. Thanks to the Gorilla Gardens riot, the war between youth and authorities was suddenly mainstream news.
These rioting, rampaging, ill-mannered, misguided punk rockers are in the minority. But if we ignore or condone their boozing and their drug-taking antics, we'll make heroes of them in the eyes of the other teenagers.
Lou Guzzo's rant aired the night after the riot. He didn't know it at the time, but he was now embroiled in a punk rock art project. Because Guzzo's spiel didn't sit well with David Portnow and his friends in the Dehumanizers. And the band's bassist happened to be an intern at Cairo TV. And he happened to know where Cairo kept the Guzzo recordings.
He actually walked out of Cairo with the actual tapes.
Well, that caught the attention of our commentator Lou Guzzo, and Lou tonight says he thinks a crackdown is in order.
I have to ask a question, Gary. Who needs teenage punk rock nightclubs anyway?
In fact, the Dehumanizers took Guzzo's voice and built a song with it. They gave it a catchy title, too. Kill Lou Guzzo.
And the issue is nightclubs for teenagers as well as the punk rockers that they attract. I can't buy the argument that we must provide nightclubs for teenagers because they don't have anything to do.
Hostile, but also tongue-in-cheek. The singer takes shots at Guzzo, his wife, and his daughter. David pressed 500 copies of Kill Lou Guzzo on 45 and released them on his record label. Like the Enemy song Trendy Violence, here you have artists repurposing the sound of oppression as a kind of liberation. It's a thumb in the eye of authority, using the man's own words against him. Art as guerrilla media warfare. Kill Lou Guzzo probably would have stayed in the underground, a punk rock retaliation unnoticed by normies. But Cairo made a grave error. They raised the stakes.
I got a letter in the mail saying they were suing my father, Howard Portnow, myself, David Portnow, my brother, Ed Portnow, for $2 million. And they ordered a cease and desist. We got the mail, you know, before my parents came home from work, and he and I are outside freaking out like, why, man, we've been in trouble before, but now we really, really done it.
Dave and his brother gave the letter to their dad. He read it, then asked to hear the song. Then he asked to hear Guzzo's tirade. He took it all in. David was surprised by his reaction.
It's like, you know, this is very remnant of a Hitler speech. He's substituting the word punk rockers for what could have been Jews, what could have been blacks, which could have been Hispanics. And my dad was very offended and say, I want you guys to call the ACLU and they'll probably find you some representation.
The ACLU publicly shamed Cairo for going after a bunch of teenagers for millions of dollars they obviously didn't have. Meanwhile, David came up with his own way to stick it to the station. He repressed the Kill Lou Guzzo 45, and this time he included a copy of the cease and desist letter with the record. Punk rock zines picked up the story, then more conventional outlets.
Then the Seattle Times wrote about it, the PI, the Tacoma paper, the Everett paper, and then Cairo finally realized, we gotta stop this, you know, we're getting slaughtered.
The song became a local hit. Wilting under the negative attention, Cairo dropped the lawsuit. But Lou Guzzo, he never shook the song.
He took the dehumanizers to his grave with him. The obituaries in the Times and the PI mentioned that he was considered radical for his time. And then it went on to say he was most notorious for a song by the Seattle skate band, the Dehumanizers.
Like so many adults throughout history, Lou Guzzo simply didn't understand young people. Guzzo, the Seattle mayor, and the Seattle City Council, their ignorance fueled their crusade.
If you really paid attention, a lot of the people that were part of the punk rock scene were very, very, very politically aware, socially aware. They weren't just a bunch of drunks and drug addicts. A lot of these people would go on to become upstanding members of the community. Some of these people are prepping and learning their way to become doctors or lawyers or people that are going to make an impact on the community.
Coming up after the break, the battle between punks and police rages on in Seattle, and the city takes even more extreme measures to crack down on all ages music.
At Soundside, we bring you news and conversation rooted in the Pacific Northwest. Hi, I'm Libby Denkman. I think of my job hosting Soundside as, number one, asking tough questions of powerful people, the questions you, KUOW listeners, want answered. And two, bringing you a daily slice of the fascinating, confounding, and often goofy side of life in Washington State. Join me for Soundside at noon and 8 p.m. on KUOW or anytime on the Soundside podcast.
2 months after the Guerrilla Gardens riot, on January 26, 1986, New York hardcore band Reagan Youth was set to play the United Travelers Hall in Lower Queen Anne. Once again, David Portnow was working the door. Cops caught wind of the show and, once again, without warning, stormed in and pulled the plug. According to a newspaper report, during the mayhem, punks firebombed a phone booth and looted a convenience store.
In the end, the police always win, but the police were given absolute hell. And they didn't expect it. They thought they could just beat people and come in and impose their will. And the difference I've noticed between punk rockers and other audiences, they all stood up for their rights.
The Guerrilla Gardens riot shocked the city and directed attention to the growing punk rock subculture. The turmoil at Travelers Hall elevated tensions to 11. These incidents were visible enough and destructive enough to raise concern for public safety. City leaders responded by proposing further limitations on freedoms for young people. A year after the TDO started, officials lobbied for a citywide teen curfew. One of the architects of the TDO, Seattle City Attorney Doug Jewett, floated the idea. Mayor Charles Royer was all for it. The curfew would make it illegal for people 14 and under to be in public places between midnight and 5 a.m. without a parent or guardian. Royer explained his intentions to a TV news reporter.
My goal is to send a message to parents that we're supportive of their efforts with their children, and to send a message to children in this city that there is a standard of behavior that has been adopted as city policy and will be enforced.
The ACLU was opposed.
It will leave an impression that there is a solution being created for the problem of youth who are on the street, and it is simply a shotgun approach saying everyone should be home. It is a disservice to the community.
The city held a public forum that brought out parents, city officials, and dozens of teenage activists to argue for and against in front of news cameras.
Instead of seriously working to solve youth problems, the city of Seattle continues to attack the youth in every section of life.
Seattle teenagers who are on their own, who support themselves, or who have the freedom to roam the streets see a curfew as a direct attack on their rights. Supporters say a curfew would protect younger kids from the dangers of the streets, drugs, and violence. Jay Bradshaw was one of the few teenagers arrested during a so-called riot when police closed a teen dance club. Charges were dropped. Now he's leading a fight for youth rights and against a curfew for 14-year-olds.
I can't tell the difference between a 14-year-old and a 16-year-old or a 16-year-old and an 18-year-old. There's going to be police going around everywhere. Can I see your ID? You know? It sounds a little bit like a pass law in South Africa to me.
Other teens chimed in too.
If my parents are allowing me to be out that late, then why am I going to have to be harassed by police just for walking down the street?
But the head of the city attorney's criminal division wouldn't budge.
For 200 years, society has said children do not have all the rights of adults. It's a fact of life.
The city council voted down the curfew, claiming it was too restrictive. But all this worry about public safety in Seattle overlapped with the paranoia parents were feeling about their kids across the U.S. Whether it was punk rock, disco, drugs, or Dungeons and Dragons, a perfect storm of bad influences was leading good kids astray. The nation's leaders were sending a message. Children don't have rights because they're under threat, and they depend on adults to protect them.
Today, there's a drug and alcohol abuse epidemic in this country, and no one is safe from it. Not you, not me, and certainly not our children, because this epidemic has their names written on it.
First Lady Nancy Reagan's response to the perceived epidemic was simple. Young people should just say no. The anti-drug assault started from the top and trickled down into mass media. TV PSAs depicted a frying egg as your brain on drugs. DARE told kids to resist drug abuse. Even Mr. T chimed in.
I just want to check some sense into you kids that are using drugs and think about using. So remember, don't, or else.
Meanwhile, Tipper Gore, wife of Democratic Senator Al Gore, was fighting to save America's youth from a new demon, heavy metal music.
I'm Mark Lieber, I'm very guilty.
In 1985, the same year Seattle passed the TDO, Tipper convened a congressional hearing about pop music she deemed objectionable. Frank Zappa and John Denver spoke on behalf of artists, stating their anti-censorship position.
It's an ill-conceived piece of nonsense which fails to deliver any real benefits to children.
They were mostly laughed at. A pastor representing the Parents Music Resource Center closed the session with a 15-minute-long audio-visual presentation. He projected album cover art from Ozzy Osbourne, Metallica, AC/DC, Twisted Sister, Judas Priest. And he read song lyrics, too. Remember that Seattle band The Mentors that played the opening night at the Bird? For his closing statement, this guy read the lyrics to their song Golden Showers out loud to Congress.
Golden showers, all through my excrements you shall roam. Bend up and smell my anal vapor. Your face is my toilet paper. On your face I leave a shit tower. Golden showers. Mr. Chairman,
all right,
that concludes my remarks, and I thank you.
I'm sorry your time has expired.
Likely the only time the phrase anal vapor has been uttered in the halls of Congress. In Seattle, the teen dance ordinance codified the same changing social mores. And it had its intended effect. The monastery was shut down. Remaining all-ages clubs were pressured into closing. Seattle's youth culture, once vibrant and thriving, was being squeezed to death. What was playing out in D.C. and Seattle was a continuation of the nation's difficult reckoning with youth culture, which itself was a relatively new concept. Whether young people were flappers, beatniks, hippies, or punks, adults used laws, propaganda, and intimidation to reel them in. Generational growing pains were not new, but now it was baby boomers pushing law and order. 20 years earlier, they were dancing to objectionable music, using recreational drugs, and scaring their parents. As usual, it added up to a difficult time to be young in America. In Seattle, kids watched as the places and the music they loved were vilified, torn down, taken away, all in the name of their own protection.
It's 10 o'clock on a Friday night. The youth of Seattle align themselves on the streets of this city as they wait for the night to be over. The shop owners and police wish that the kids were not there. They wish they'd go away, go home. This will not happen. In the last
Paul Euler was a 16-year-old high school senior in 1986. He went to punk shows back when they were legal and even had his own band. He and a friend made a short film for a class project with a borrowed VHS camera. It's a fascinating artifact of the time, depicting Seattle from a teen's eye view. They called it Ain't Nothing to Do.
It's important that people of all ages can hear it because music has a lot more impact on younger people.
The title comes from a Dead Boys song covered by Green River. The film was Paul's way of getting out of writing a paper, but Ain't Nothing to Do is more than an easy A. The frustration it captures is palpable. These kids had an impressively firm grasp on what was being taken away from them and what they wanted to do about it. Remember what Keith Morris said about young punks growing up and contributing to society? Well, today, Paul is CEO of a marketing agency in Seattle. He remembers his punk rock days as a time of ingenuity and teamwork.
These punk rock shows that they shut down were all like DIY and people are helping out and like grab my ear. Okay, I have a PA, let me run and get it. So it had this real like community feel. I think the opposite of what they were afraid of was happening at these things if right. they were, right?
Some kind of antisocial behavior.
Yeah, it was actually like super social. Right. Yeah, you know, and around music, right? And like just young people making music as wholesome as you can get on some level. It was a really cool scene that I guess they successfully snubbed out.
DIY was a real ethos in the music scene back then, a spirit of autonomy that built a safe and sustaining community without outside assistance or intervention. But if it's true that some punks were working together to build a scene, others were just trying to tear the world down. Thanks to the TDO, all ages shows had dried up inside Seattle city limits. Young music fans had to go to the suburbs to find their scene. On the night of October 2nd, 1987, hundreds of punks took a ferry across the Puget Sound to the Navy town of Bremerton. Natasha's had been an all-ages hotspot for as long as anyone could remember. In the 1940s and 50s, it hosted teen dances and sock hops. In the 60s and 70s, all-ages concerts by iconic acts like Duke Ellington, Chubby Checker, Van Morrison, and Hart. By the 1980s, it was mostly punk bands. That night in October, UK hardcore band GBH headlined, and Seattle favorites The Accused opened. The show went down as usual, kids letting loose in a big circle pit, sneaking beers and joints in the parking lot, tons of unbottled energy. After the show wrapped up, fans made their way back to downtown Bremerton to catch the Kitsap Ferry, all 328 feet and 3,300 tons of her. The audio you're about to hear is from a short 2018 film about that late-night boat ride back to Seattle. It's called The Infamous Kitsap Ferry Riot.
It started when apparently one woman started doing a belly dance of some kind, got the crowd kind of worked up.
Not to be outdone, some dude urinated in a potted plant, or all over the place, depending on who you ask. The crowd howled in approval. Two cops aboard the boat nabbed the kid and hauled him off. The crowd went berserk.
The inside of the boat was trashed. Ceilings, floors, and doors damaged heavily. The violence began after two Bremerton police officers assigned to ride late-night weekend runs arrested a youth for urinating on the benches and windows.
Another punk spit at the ferry police. Cops took him and the urinating teen into a small office and locked the door. Someone tore an axe from the fire kit and tried to chop their way through. This time around, the problem wasn't overzealous police. It was kids behaving badly. But none of it would have happened if the TDO didn't force fans to leave the city just to see a show.
Someone started chanting, get the cops, you know, kill the cops.
Members of The Accused were on the ferry, but they didn't get involved. One band member told a local reporter that he hid out in his car.
There was a few outlandish kids, I'm sure, who wanted to say that they were more punk than the other kids, you know, so they grabbed fire axes and things like that. Unfortunately, that puts a bad name on, you know, on the punk scene, and it makes it harder for us to play gigs.
Dozens of police officers were waiting on the Seattle side. They inspected disembarking cars to find hiding teens, and they arrested five. A few days later, the New York Times reported the story. Yes, the Kitsap Ferry punk rock riot was national news. The Times asked the singer of GBH to comment. He said he was, quote, quietly proud. After three high-profile blow-ups between punks and police in less than 2 years, it's safe to say many Seattleites had an unfavorable view of the local music scene. To these folks, the repressive spirit of the teen dance ordinance made sense. Now musicians and music fans faced a battle on two fronts, public perception and city regulation. That combination left a lot of bands behind. Do you wanna be rich? Do you wanna be Take young Paul Euler, for example. After he graduated high school, he focused on his band, SGM. SGM put out a single on Sub Pop Records and opened a show for Nirvana. As they grew out of their teenage years, the band changed its name to Sweetwater, and Sweetwater did pretty well. They signed to Atlantic Records, recorded a couple major label albums, and went on tours with Pearl Jam and Alice in Chains. But even as they leveled up, they had a hard time finding smaller venues in Seattle to perform, develop, and hone their skills. The TDO cut them off.
You know, analyzing the TDO and how it was sort of probably suffocating, it made it harder to be in a band and to grow as a band.
A handful of bands did manage to emerge from this place. Over time, they became some of the biggest bands in the world. Sweetwater may have suffocated, but Paul recognized that the collective community wouldn't go down so easily.
There was such a wave and so much momentum in the music scene at the time, like nothing was really gonna stop it, right? So like, okay, if that's then, we'll bob and weave, we're still gonna find ways to play shows, and there's so many bands. Despite the city's efforts, this felt like it was just gonna happen no matter what.
You can see the pendulum process working here. An all-ages music scene bubbles up in Seattle. Cops and politicians beat it down with the TDO. The music community was put under such tremendous pressure that it was bound to collapse, or it was going to explode. Grunge was about to take over the world. But what most music fans didn't know about Seattle, and probably wouldn't believe, is that the city's young people were left outside looking in.
We can't pretend that Nirvana existed and Seattle music existed in 1991 and beyond as this like incredibly vibrant access to the arts community. It was exactly the opposite of that. Exactly the opposite.
In our next episode, Seattle music changes pop culture forever. And in the midst of the city's celebrity supernova, a local politician sets out to tear down its youth culture entirely. For KUOW in Seattle, I'm Jonathan Zwickel, and this is Let the Kids Dance. Let the Kids Dance is a production of KUOW in Seattle. We're a member of the NPR Network, a coalition of independent, listener-supported public media podcasts. Let the Kids Dance is created and written by me, Jonathan Zwickel. Matt Martin produced the show. Jim Gates is our editor. Final mixing by Hans Twite. Original music is by Ryan Devlin and Kim West of Smokey Brights and Mega Cat. Our theme song is by The Four Slicks, covering Bo Diddley. CM Ruiz designed our logo. Special thanks to University of Washington Archive and Cairo 7 for their TV footage. Our production team includes Marshall Eisen, Michaela Giannotti-Boyle, Marian Muhammad, Brendan Sweeney, and Lauren Vespoli. Want to hear more awesome music from the TDO era? Dive into the Let the Kids Dance playlist. Check out the link in our show notes or search LTKD on Spotify. Hey, listeners, do you like going to all-ages shows? Did you when you were younger? Did you live through the teen dance ordinance in Seattle? Or were you part of an all-ages scene somewhere else? Tell us about it. Record a voice message on your phone and email it to dance@kuow.org. Thanks for listening.
Hey, my name's Claire McGrain, and I'm a producer for Seattle Now, KUOW's local news podcast. There is a lot happening in our region, and it's a lot of work to keep track of it all. We'll get you caught up on the latest news and take a deep dive into something happening around the city, all in under 15 minutes. Get a morning walk in or grab a cup of coffee and start your day with us. Learn something new and connect with our city by searching for Seattle Now wherever you get your podcasts.